Chris and Cheryl are going to do some sort of a tag team act, apparently. They're jointly working on they're finishing a book, which is a book which deals with the 50th anniversary of C.P. Snow's Two Cultures, as a couple of people mentioned today. Chris is also a contributing editor to Science Progress, senior correspondent for the American Prospect, author of The Republican War on Science, you may remember that little book, and a book on Stormworld. He writes an intersection blog with Cheryl, who was at Duke, still at Duke, works on ocean science, has worked with senators, and is now a science writer and seed blogger, also based at Duke University. So off you go.
It's really good to be here. This presentation is not scripted. We're going to do it together, but we didn't prepare to do it together. If we'd prepared, I think we'd both be wearing our Save Pluto t-shirts, because one of our arguments is we have to reconnect science with American culture, and the best way to do that is not to take people's planets away. But let me tell you briefly why we're here. First of all, why I'm here, and then why Cheryl's here with me. As you heard, in 2005, I published a book called The Republican War on Science. At the outset of talks, I like to disclose there was no conscious intention to echo the cover image of another popular book you may or may not be familiar with. So we really only noticed that later. And then Time Magazine copied both of us. But the book, you know, created dialogue, so like any author would do, I went out on the road to give talks about the subject matter. And in my early series of talks, trying to be a science communicator, I had a strategy for communication. It was unveil this long litany of all the different ways in which the Bush administration attacked science, and I would speak to audiences of people who cared about science like yourselves. This form of communicating would prompt a lot of outrage, a lot of anger on the part of the people in the audience. And then at the end, all of the hands would go up, and they would all say, you know, I cannot believe what you're telling me. This makes me very angry. It makes me want to punch a wall. I can't believe this kind of crap is going on in my government. You haven't given me any release. You haven't told me what I can do about this problem. And I realized my instinctual answer to that question, which was, oh, buy the book, was probably insufficient. So I started looking, thinking about new answers, new solutions to what was really a broad science, politics, society disconnect. Precisely what Naomi was telling us about on the climate issue extends across a large number of issues. And what kind of answers? How do we reconnect science and society? How do we reconnect science and culture? Well, we've got to do something about science in the political process. We've got to do something about science communication. We've got to do something to make science relevant, broadly relevant to people other than scientists. Well, it was at this point that I started collaborating with Cheryl. And I like to joke that one of the reasons I collaborate with her is because she's happy, and that makes her productive, and I'm angst-ridden and starting trouble, and she gets things done. But she's going to tell you a little bit about her perspective briefly on how to reconnect science with an important walk of what we do, which is the political system, and how she knows something about that. And then we're going to launch into the substance of what we did together.
Mm-hmm. Well, I first want to say, too, that I'm so honored to be here among so many inspiring individuals and part of this Beyond Belief conference. I came to this in a very different way from the world of academia, and now kind of merging with the world of policy, the world of greater science communication. I began as a sea cucumber biologist. I was in grad school at the University of Maine and working on the underappreciated but ever charismatic sea cucumber, and also earning a degree in policy at the same time. So straight from there, I went on to one of these congressional fellowships working with Senator Bill Nelson. And from day one, I felt just like Heinlein would say, a stranger in a strange land. I was shocked at how little science seemed to inform the decision-making process, and realized that I had been in many ways living within this bubble. I mean, someone asked me on day one, so this global climate change thing, is that real? And that surprised me, because all of the conversations that I had in grad school, all of the conversations that I was having at home with my friends, it seemed like a consensus. But as Naomi was just saying, a lot of people, I still think the jury's out. And why is that happening? Well, you have all sorts of organized institutions, nonprofits, associations coming to Congress to brief members and staffers about the problems, about keeling, about the curves, but with very different messages, and speaking in p-values and statistics, To staffers who are going home and watching the same reality TV shows that my friends at home in New York are watching, and not really grabbing them in a way that's engaging. The Pew Commission would come in and give a briefing for staffers, and a few people would show up in the room. Whereas the George Marshall Institute, which many of you may know of, would come in with just very charismatic, articulate speakers talking about Michael Crichton serving food, which is a big deal. And it was a packed room. So clearly there were different languages being used, almost like what I was joking happened on Tuesday night with the vice presidential debates. I mean, it was like two different conversations happening, and staffers who, for the most part, are very intelligent, well-educated people, not quite knowing who to believe. And so I saw that as a very clear problem and something that I was going to have to go on and continue working on rather than just keeping my focus within the ivory towers. And then I began collaborating with Chris.
And I guess that brings us to this election season. In all likelihood, the next president is going to decide many crucial science-based political issues. How will we resolve global warming? What will be our stem cell policy? Hopefully we'll get that out of the way really quickly, and then we'll go on to all sorts of other bioethical kinds of issues which are going to be colliding with us. We might even have to decide, will we geoengineer the planet? Will we militarize space? I don't know. We're going to need scientific information for all of these kinds of issues, and yet science is barely being discussed on the campaign trail. This is the disconnect between the world of science and the world of politics. So Cheryl and I blogged together, and what we did was we got together with a couple of other interested individuals to create an initiative called Science Debate 2008. And why don't you tell us a little bit about how we did it, and then we'll get into some of the points about why it did or didn't work and what that tells us about the relationship between science and politics.
Well, backtracking a little bit more back to my graduate years in Maine, I was concurrently, you know, well, literally elbow deep in sea cucumbers a lot of the time, but I was also working in pop radio for Cumulus Media as a pop radio top 40 DJ. And I started to notice this trend, whereas we'd hold these seminars at the university, and if 20 people showed up in the room, it was a smashing success. And then we'd try to do a fundraiser for something like helping the victims of a hurricane on the radio station, and we'd have 2,000 people come out. So what did this media group know about social marketing that the university was missing? Now, arguably, they might not be focused on outreach at that scale, but there were very different ways of engaging broad groups. And so through blogging, Chris and I reach an enormous audience. I mean, we've had months where we almost reach, you know, 100,000 page views, which is a lot, because journals and publishing, it's so important, but a lot of people don't have their hands on that. It's not usually freely and openly accessible. So Science Debate is unique because it was launched through new media. We got a coalition together of bloggers, and I also want to say our original steering committee was Chris and myself, a writer and someone grounded in science, also astrophysicist Lawrence Krauss, who I don't think is here yet, but will be coming, and two screenwriters and a philosopher, Matthew Chapman, who's Darwin's great-great-grandson and also behind Runaway Jury. John Lawrence Otto, who you see on the bottom, was involved with House of Sand and Fog. So a motley crew of different individuals. But we all kind of have different techniques of bringing people together, and I think that was really a strength of this. So using the blogosphere, which here's our blog, it's called The Intersection. It's, as you can see, the Constitution and the DNA strand, so we want to be at the intersection of science and policy and culture, to talk about calling for a presidential science debate. And we let our readers know, we built this coalition of all these science bloggers, both on Seed Science blogs and well beyond, to really keep beating the drum and getting people to be thinking about why these issues in the environment, in medicine, in all of these different arenas that we work on individually are so important, and we should be speaking in a broader voice together about getting a national focus on them for our next candidates and in the next administration.
Just one thing I'd like to remark upon about this. This initiative did not come centrally from the world of science. As Cheryl mentioned, it came from science bloggers. There was one well-recognized scientist who was part of our original organizing committee, Lawrence Krauss, but centrally involved were these two Hollywood screenwriters, Matthew Chapman and Sean Lawrence Otto, really running the show now. And as I like to joke, if the Hollywood writers had not gone on strike in the fall, of 2007, which was exactly when we organized this. I don't know. These guys couldn't write. They couldn't work. They had to do something. So they're like, let's create a presidential science debate. Otherwise, there may not have been one. Well, was it a success? That's the question. Unfortunately, in my opinion, no, it was not. We got the candidates to answer a list of 14 science policy questions, which you might have seen online. I encourage you to read them. They're very substantive. They're very meaty. But we could not get them to commit to events, despite having set up a pretty desirable one, we thought, in a battleground state, Pennsylvania, just before the April primary, at the Franklin Institute in Philadelphia. So we were ready. We built it. They didn't come. My whole goal with the Science Debate 2008 initiative was to elevate the prominence of science in the election so as to communicate the importance of science more broadly beyond the world of science. And without the candidates, and frankly without television, we didn't succeed in that way. And so the question is why? Why did the candidates not participate? Why was this not a priority? Why was the nation's brain trust so easily ignored? And that's a question that I think we need a little bit of historical information upon. And one way to think about the answer is to look at what has happened to the standing of science in our society over the past 50 years and also trends in media attention to it. So post the launch of Sputnik, the year 1958, science was big stuff in America. And at the same time, science media efforts were booming. Eisenhower was creating the Presidential Science Advisor Post and the President's Science Advisory Commission. He said later, I think, you know, close to his death, that, you know, he called them my scientists. And he said, this bunch of scientists were the only people in Washington I could turn to who didn't seem like they were in it for themselves. They were actually in it for the country, or something to that effect. So science was a subject to be discussed by presidents, and the presidents cared about. Since then, we've seen a fairly steep decline in the cultural relevance of science today. Now, not the substantive relevance of science to policy. It matters a ton. Here I've got an image of geoengineering schemes that might occur. Okay, you know, if we're going to decide to do that, or decide that it's a really bad idea, if we can't head off global warming any other way, we're really going to need science, and that's one of only so many issues on which that's the case. But the relevance of science is not what it was 50 years ago. And why is that the case? Well, one reason is the steep decline in media treatment of science. Let me give you a little bit. People always complain about science writers. Well, the biggest problem with science writers today is that they're losing their jobs. Not that they're not good at it, but that there's no position for them anymore in a lot of publications. Here's Rick Weiss, one of the top science writers on biomedical issues, recently left the Washington Post. Because they cut the science section. Well, that's something that's been going on for the past 10 years for a long time. A study by the Shorenstein Center from 89 to 2005, number of major newspapers featuring weekly science sections shrinks by nearly two-thirds. If you look at the Science Writer Organization, which I'm a member of, as of 2005, just 7% of the members of the National Association of Science Writers had full-time positions at major media outlets. The rest of them are freelancers, or they're actually university public relations people. And then the Washington Post has gotten rid of its science section. And the mass media, the TV media, you know, even worse. A study from Pew, if you watch 5 hours of cable news, expect to see 1 minute devoted to science and technology. Another study found something like, for the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, the percentage of front page stories that were some way about science and technology was slightly under 1%. You have the science-centric media, but how much science is actually being covered there? I don't think there's anything today like Carl Sagan's Cosmos reached a huge amount of people with scientific information. Now, why? Why has the mass media become so science anemic? Well, I think there's two important factors, and let me just editorialize here a little bit. I really, really think that scientists ought to study the media as scientifically as they study everything else, because it would vastly increase their influence. So what's happening in the media? One trend is conglomeration. Fewer and fewer companies own more and more parts of the media. And because things are being run from the top down, they're trying to please shareholders, they're cutting back on expensive things like career science writers who know their beats really well and expect to get a pay raise every couple of years and expect to develop a lot of expertise in this substantive area, or international affairs reporters, or having a Washington bureau. All of these things are being cut back by conglomerates and by media outlets in general. And newspapers are also struggling vis-a-vis the internet. So we're losing out on all kinds of substantive information in the media. And that's not the only problem. The other thing that's going on is the media is becoming vastly fragmented at the same time. And this is perhaps the biggest threat to science and perhaps one of the biggest things that's knocked it off its pedestal of relevance. If you were to sit down and watch television in the evening in 1985, you pretty much, 6:30 p.m., you pretty much had four choices. You had the networks, PBS, you were going to get some news, substantive news about political affairs, probably some science. In fact, Walter Cronkite actually launched a science show in the 80s, Walter Cronkite's Universe. I don't know if you remember that. Well, what if you sit down at the same time today and watch television? You've got hundreds of cable channels to choose from. And what this means is that for a citizen who doesn't care, doesn't have much interest in science, they don't have to get any of it at all. They can just watch the Food Network. Or they can watch Fox News, and they can self-select themselves not only out of science content, but into ideological attacks on science content. And that will be their source of information. If you look at how Fox talks about global warming evolution, it's not scientifically accurate, but that's all that people are getting. So we can no longer assume that the American public is getting really much information at all from the scientific community. We've got science blogs, but again, we have this selection effect. The media is a smorgasbord of choices, and people who care about science are the ones who are reading science blogs, and so that's why we whipped up the science community real fast with blogs, with Facebook. Everybody's like, rah, rah, let's have a science debate, okay? But only, for the most part, science-centric media covered Science Debate 2008. Mass media didn't, and so it wasn't put on the candidate's agenda.
Chris, could I just interject one thing, though, which is to remind everybody that you had an enormous collection of scientific organizations around.
Yeah, I guess we didn't actually say that.
Amazing collection of people.
Yeah.
We had hundreds of universities signed on, Nobel laureates, people in and out of the public eye came together more rapidly than had ever happened before for a movement like this. And that in itself is historic, but that's also not enough. And I think that's the message that we want to drum home here.
I'm sorry, I'm so pessimistic. Yes, that's the crazy thing, is the science community wants now, perhaps more than ever before, to connect with politics, partly because we're so unhappy about the Bush administration and all the attacks on science. That's really roused people. There's also the international competitiveness issues. Vis-a-vis China and India, that have also really made people think, oh my God, science policy better be taken seriously, or else we have to worry about our economic engine. Mm-hmm. So we really want to reach out. It's very easy to get the science community to say, listen, please listen.
And nearly, I'm sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, and right now, just the sheer number of papers coming across my desk every week that are one organization or one institute or one university or one think tank's package, white paper, to hand to the new administration. It's mind-blowing. And I just have to wonder, when they get all of these reports about science recommendations for 2009 and beyond, what are they going to do with them? Are they going to have a science advisor to take a look at it, or is it going to get shelved and they're going to go back to CRS? Your guess is as good as mine, because I really don't know. But I think that there's an information overload going on right now, and it's going to continue, because everyone wants to carve out their niche. And I don't know if that's the best way to do it.
So the fundamental problem that we want to argue is that science matters more than ever to decision making. Science probably matters more than ever to the individual lives of the citizens. But science's cultural relevance is extraordinarily low, and so it doesn't have the influence it deserves, and doesn't have the relevance it deserves to non-scientists. How do we go about solving that? I think that it's driven by divides between scientists and politics. Scientists are not connecting with the political system. They're not connecting with the mass media, and they're not understanding it. There are also two other sectors, one of which is going to get me in a lot of trouble with this audience, which is the polarization of science in the religious community. And then the last one is science in the entertainment media. The most powerful part of the media is where science is not really coming across. Let me give you an example. Naomi talked about the climate issue, and she mentioned the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's reports on global warming. So a study was done by Anthony Lacerowitz, I believe he's now at Yale, looking at the global warming blockbuster The Day After Tomorrow. And so it turns out that this movie reached 21 million people, 10% of the U.S. population, according to his study. And just the spin-off media coverage of the movie, not the movie itself, but just like people writing about the movie, was equal to 10 times the media coverage that the 2001 Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report received. So no wonder we're not reaching people about science. And also the people who saw the movie, the 21 million, even that was not enough to significantly move public opinion about global warming. So one of the biggest disconnects is the role of science in the entertainment industry. And that's something I want to talk about very briefly. In the movies, what are scientists? They're freaks, geeks, or villains. They're the mad scientists playing God. They look like this, right? A lot of film and television narratives are about the paranormal and pseudoscience. We just, J.J. Abrams' show Fringe just launched. It's not just that the things are inaccurate, but the storylines are not remotely scientifically plausible. I just watched The Core, where the core stops spinning, and then they drill into the center of the Earth to fix it using the material unobtainium. Let me show you some other faces of science and entertainment. There's Ben Stein making scientists look bad, even back then, before Expelled.
And I also just want to throw onto that, I don't know if you guys are aware, but when Expelled came out, they were actually doing private briefings, screenings for members of Congress with question and answer periods afterwards. And that stuff was reaching staff makers, policy makers. Are we?
Hey, here's the 80s. And just a couple more. So the broad argument is that we have to find, and in our Candle in the Dark, which we'll talk about more tomorrow, is we have to mobilize the people who care about science and put them into intersection with the entertainment industry, with the media, with the political system in new ways. And we'll talk about actually the manpower that would be required to do that and how, in fact, it exists already, because there's a lot of postdocs who can't advance because there aren't enough positions for them and things like that. But just to go on, perhaps one of the most polarizing things, one of the reasons that people can't connect with science is because they believe that science is an attack on their religious beliefs. Okay, I'm an atheist. I agree with you about almost everything you say when you're attacking religion. However, most of America just doesn't compute for them. So we have, on the one hand, we have the young earth creationist America. On the other hand, we have the leaders of science who overwhelmingly don't accept religion. And when it's construed as a battle between the two extremes squeeze out the middle, and people think they can't have their science because it will be an assault on their core values. All of which, unfortunately, leave science kind of alone, alienated at the table. Nobody wants to sit with it. And so we've got to reconnect science. The South Park version. We got to reconnect science with religion, entertainment, media, and politics. So we need collaborations like Science Debate 2008, but bigger. And we need to succeed breakthrough in the media in a way that we didn't there. But for that to happen, this is my last point, and then we'll end. Sorry, it's two of us, right? Don't we get 30 minutes? We have to grapple with an episode in the history of the scientific community. And that episode is 1992, the snubbing of Carl Sagan. Greatest science communicator in a generation. He was present on television and in film, which is really how today you reach a lot of people. Being on the Johnny Carson show, Cosmos reaching hundreds of millions of people, Contact the Hollywood movie version. He also was a good writer. And a good scientist, but nevertheless, when he came up for membership in the National Academies, he needed 3/4. He got 1/2. And that's the kind of thing that we have to change if this kind of outreach and cultural relevance of science is going to happen. Thank you.
Great, thank you.